This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the High Yield Cash Account on public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A High Yield Cash Account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
The Trump Taj Mahal's swan song, a gold rush in Mauritania, and everything you never knew you didn't know about the raccoon fur trade. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, filling in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, September 5th. Thanks for being with us. We begin this Labor Day with a story about workers in trouble. Donald Trump doesn't own the Trump Taj Mahal in Atlantic City anymore. His stake was wiped out when it declared bankruptcy and billionaire investor Carl Icahn took over. But the casino is still in trouble. Just under 1,000 workers there went on strike on July 1st. And now the Trump Taj Mahal says it'll close next month. So what will happen to all those employees? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer takes a look.
James Mays has been a cook at the Trump Taj Mahal for 15 years.
I'm an excellent cook. I'm probably one of the best cooks in this whole building.
Mays is standing with a group of striking service workers at the entrance to the casino. Bellmen, cooks, maids, and other workers represented by Unite Here. The union wants health insurance and pension benefits restored. They were taken away when the casino declared bankruptcy. Workers had to pay for their own insurance. That was especially hard on Mays because his wife had cancer.
It was like $704 every month, and it came like every 15 days. You can never be late, but like one time. And it had to keep going if you want your family to stay alive.
Mays' wife died a year ago. The casino's management told me it's closing because the union is asking for too much. The union says management has threatened to close before and is just bluffing. Mays says the workers will keep fighting for a standard benefit package, like other casino workers in town have.
People don't want to give up what they had here. And then people have been here so long, and you gave your blood, sweat, and tears, your hardest on this job.
But it won't be easy for all of the 3,000 workers at the Trump Taj Mahal to find jobs if it does close. There's already a glut of laid-off workers because 4 Atlantic City casinos closed in 2014. Stephen Norton is a former casino manager who now works as a consultant.
When you've closed 4 casinos already and a 5th one is closed, when your casino revenues are down more than 50%, there are obviously not nearly as many jobs on the casino floor.
Ellen Mutari is a professor of economics at Stockton University near Atlantic City. She says some of the city's laid-off workers did find jobs at other casinos on the East Coast. For others, it was just too hard to move.
We have the highest foreclosure rate of any county in the United States. So it's very difficult to actually just pick up and move for a job if you're underwater on your home.
Mutari says Atlantic City's unemployment rate is now over 7%. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
This week, President Obama becomes the first sitting U.S. president to visit the Southeast Asian nation of Laos. Some fun facts about Laos. Its population is just under 7 million. It borders Vietnam, Cambodia, Thailand, Myanmar, and China. And as it happens, the Lao economy has been in transition for a little while now. Marketplace's Lewis Wallace looks at some of the controversy around that transition.
Laos has a small population, a hilly terrain with a lot of subsistence farming and fishing, and it's sandwiched between China, Vietnam, Thailand, and Cambodia. Its economy is pretty dependent on those neighbors, especially China. Tejinan Ponsadirak heads the Institute of Security and International Studies at Chulalongkorn University in Thailand. He says Laos is trying to move away from that dependency on China.
It's trying to diversify, it's trying to depend more on Vietnam and other countries so that it does not have to rely excessively on China.
Amy Seawright with the Center for Strategic and International Studies says the U.S. is encouraging that shift.
Having an independent Laos is important for the United States.
Because the U.S. is concerned about the balance of power in the region and generally keeping China in check. Much of Laos's recent development is a result of international involvement. Hydropower is the biggest industry. Seawright says Laos' communist government has supported letting outside investors build dams.
It sees this development of its electricity generation as really important to its economic future.
But opening up Laos to development hasn't always benefited the Lao people, says Ian Baird, a geographer at the University of Wisconsin.
The benefits are not being evenly distributed, nor are the costs.
The dams on the Mekong and other rivers displace people and cause problems for fish, a main food source. But the power mostly gets sold to other countries. Other types of development, like large-scale agriculture, have also displaced people. And while poverty has somewhat lessened over the last couple decades, inequality has grown. I'm Lewis Wallace for Marketplace.
Markets are closed in the U.S. for the Labor Day holiday, but elsewhere in the world, oil prices had numbers up and down. We will have all the details when we do our numbers. Let's keep up our world tour today. The world's newest gold rush is happening in the Sahara Desert. Some fun facts about the West African country of Mauritania. It is the 11th largest nation in Africa, population 3.9 million-ish. Many of them are nomads. It's rich in mineral resources, and a recent government decision to let people dig in the sand for those resources has people across the country giving up everything in the hope of striking it rich. The BBC's Hanan Razik has this report.
Under the baking desert sun, the men here spend hours digging. The beep from the metal detector could be the first sign their luck is about to change. Makeshift tents and meter-wide holes are the only landmarks in this barren land. Tales of making tens of thousands of dollars has triggered a gold rush that's attracting thousands of Mauritanians from different walks of life. They all have one dream in common, to become rich.
Can you show me the gold you found? This is only today.
1 gram.
1 gram. How about yourself? 6 grams. That's a fortune, huh? Yeah.
In a country of more than 30% unemployment, being given the opportunity to dig for gold, even if it means living in punishing conditions, is irresistible.
Why did you decide to come here?
The reason I have decided to come here is because of unemployment. I'm not qualified enough. I'm here to find a better future for my wife and kids.
I've just come to the center of the desert where the digging is happening, and it's so hot here. As you walk along, you'll see tents that have become home for all those who left everything behind and moved here months ago, hoping to find some gold. As you walk along to the other side, you see many plots where the digging is actually happening. Each person has their own plot where they dig all day long, starting early morning, and the digging can go as deep as 2 meters. But it's not always a happy result, because after hours and hours and sometimes weeks of digging, all they get is a small piece of gold that's not even as much as 1 gram. In a spacious family garden in the capital, I meet Ahmed, who's about to take the long journey. Under a pomegranate tree, he sits alongside his 4 lively children and tells me he has risked everything to pursue his dream of gold.
I came back from abroad because I wanted an opportunity in my country. I brought my wife and kids back with me. I sold my house because I want to find gold, buy a new house, and start a new life.
In the early morning, he packs up his necessary equipment and drives to the desert. Before the search starts, Ahmed, along with his fellow diggers, need to buy a $300 license, a cost that is considered too high in a country where more than a quarter of the population live below the poverty line. Over a cup of tea, the local MP, Mustafa Abdelaziz, says the new decision could help many families.
The decision is based on a popular demand. The government has decided, since the average income is low, to make the license at an affordable price.
After Ahmed's big gamble and spending 27 days digging in the desert, all he could find is 6 grams of gold, barely 1% of what he spent. As the sun goes down, it's time for a couscous break. I ask Ahmed if he regrets it. He says, very. Yet, like many others, he still comes back hoping to turn his luck around.
That was the BBC's Hanan Razik. Now on to a hunt for a different kind of quarry. And let me tell you, you're about to learn a whole lot of fun facts, like what a raccoon fur trapper in Columbia, Missouri, has to do with cheap oil flooding the global market. Turns out it's a lot. Also, there's a raccoon fur market. Who knew? From member station KBIA in Missouri, Bram Sable-Smith, that's really the name, reports.
I'll bet your image of a fur trapper is of a bearded frontiersman wearing a raccoon skin hat with a tail dangling from the back. Meh, not so much. Dave Schleimer's got the beard, but that's about it. Driving the gravel roads near his home outside Columbia, Missouri, we pull up to his neighbor's barn. Most of his raccoon traps are set on the properties of his farmer neighbors who see raccoons as pests.
This guy here, my goodness, he'd go in there and there'd be 3 or 4 bags ripped open, feed wasted on the ground. And, oh, he's aggravated. And I don't know how many we caught in there. Dozen, maybe.
Catching raccoon is all about location, and Schleimer takes me to some primo trapping real estate. It's a little pond in the backwoods where raccoons go to scavenge food. But even though he's already caught 80 raccoons over the trapping season, today he's not very lucky.
I was hoping I'd have one in there. I set that the other day. I probably caught, I'll bet 7 or 8 right here this year.
But catching more raccoons is the least of his worries. The real problem is what to do with the ones he's already got. That's because demand for raccoon furs has all but dried up. Dorn Miller's been a fur buyer in Missouri for 25 years.
When things are good, things are good. When things are bad, it's bad.
How are things right now?
Bad. Real bad.
Miller's got 25,000 raccoon furs in freezer storage right now. For the past 2 years, he hasn't been able to sell a single one. He's relying instead on other animal skins to keep his business afloat. There's a reason the bottom's dropped out of the raccoon market: Russia and its oil-dependent economy.
We generally buy a lot of oil from Russia, so if we can buy oil cheap from Russia, they're not going to have the expendable capital to buy fur.
And that's a problem, because Russia is a huge market. Here's why. Raccoon looks a lot like silver fox, but comes at a fraction of the price. When the Russian economy took off in the 90s, so did demand for fur coats from the emerging middle class.
They were spending money on trips abroad. They were spending money in coffee bars and sushi restaurants. You had, you know, this tremendous inflow of wealth over about a decade.
Olga Olker of the Center for Strategic and International Studies says when oil prices plummeted a couple years ago, that boom came to a screeching halt. Tack on international sanctions over the Crimea conflict, and for the average Russian?
It means the prices have gone up and your salary has probably gone down. You know, so you go into the store and you look around and you can't afford the things you used to be able to afford.
For a sense of what that's meant for the raccoon fur market, consider this. At the North American fur auction in 2013, raccoon furs were fetching about $25 a piece. Now it's $4. Rob Cahill is the auction's VP of marketing.
It's really just shown it's hit a wall, that the market was almost entirely the Russian market. And then once you lose that one market, it's the game's up.
Which is why Dorn Miller's got 25,000 raccoon pelts in his freezers and no money to show for them.
At this point today, I don't think I could sell a raccoon pelt to anybody. So it's about as bad as it gets right now.
But you're laughing.
It'll come around. It'll be good one of these days.
He's waiting for the next market to open up. Where's that? Go ahead and say it with me. China. In Missouri, I'm Bram Sablesmith for Marketplace.
Coming up.
She was not worried about her disease or her illness. She was always worried about others.
Mother Teresa as a not very patient patient. But first, let's do the numbers. U.S. markets were closed today for Labor Day. For the rest of the world, the big non-news over its non-holiday weekend was oil prices. Saudi Arabia and Russia finally got together to talk about limiting oil production. Crude prices rose. The Saudis and Russians agreed to agree on something. Sometime, crude prices fell. European markets also fell. Britain's FTSE off 0.2%. Germany's DAX lost 0.1%. France's CAC 40 was flat in Tokyo. The Nikkei gained 0.6%. And you are listening to Marketplace. You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. And for a good many of you listening out there, tomorrow is the first day of school. But not as many of you as it used to be. Some of us, like me, packed our first lunches in a hot day in August. But either way, it's a good time to talk about the education trends to look for in this school year, from shorter summers to fewer tests to charter schools. Here's Marketplace's senior education reporter, Amy Scott. Hi, Amy.
Hey, Molly.
Okay, so my kid is already back in school. It's been a week and a half. Labor Day used to be the unofficial end of summer. Why are so many schools starting so much earlier now?
I know. I've been seeing in my Facebook feed pictures since like mid-August of people going back to school. It's definitely starting earlier in some places. Most districts in Florida started August 10th this year. And this is partly about getting enough class time in to end the semester for winter break rather than taking a week off for winter and then coming back to finish up the semester in January. But this also gives schools more time to prepare kids for standardized tests and AP exams. Of course, it can be a problem when it's 90 degrees out and, you know, schools are starting in August and don't have air conditioning, which actually happened here. A lot of schools were closed on the first couple days of school. Wow. And it's also a problem for the tourist industry.
Is there a benefit, though? I mean, is it as a parent who's mad that summer's over too soon, should I be looking at this differently?
Well, the good news is that most schools, when they start early, they end earlier, too. So a lot of kids aren't actually seeing their summer break that much shorter. But there is a movement, particularly among some charter schools, to actually increase the school year. And you've probably heard this term, summer learning loss. There's a concern that many low-income kids in particular who don't have the summer camps and the family trips to national parks that kids from wealthier families have are missing out and need to spend more time in school.
I know that charter schools are among the big stories you'll be following this year. What's happening in that arena?
Yeah. So charter schools are public schools that are independently run, and so they have a lot more flexibility, but also in some cases less oversight and accountability. And the comedian John Oliver recently did a rant on his show Last Week Tonight. And I want to play you this clip of him talking about online charter schools, which are basically virtual schools where kids take classes online from home.
One major study found, compared to kids in traditional public schools, students in online charters lost the equivalent of 72 days of learning in reading and 180 days in math during the course of a 180-day school year. And 180 minus 180 is, as those kids might put it, three.
Ouch. Yeah. Charter school defenders are naturally really upset about this. They point out that a lot of schools have been very successful, have made a big difference in kids' lives. So this debate is likely to continue.
Well, and I know there's also debate around testing. Some parents have opted their kids out of these standardized tests here in California and, of course, elsewhere around the country. What's happening there?
Congress passed a new law last year, the Every Student Succeeds Act, which replaces the much maligned No Child Left Behind law. And that the revision gives states more control over how they use tests. So states will be developing other accountability measures that are meant to kind of lessen the high stakes of tests alone. But the law still requires annual testing in reading and math starting in third grade. That's not going away. Where we might see some reduction is the extra tests that districts sort of pile on top of those state tests.
And then, of course, we have an election coming up. And I feel like, granted, it could be the bubble, but I feel like I haven't heard much about education from either candidate.
Really, college is getting the most attention, and partly because, you know, it's a huge issue that animates voters of all ages, but especially young voters. That was a big part of Bernie Sanders' popularity. Clinton has a free college plan that would make tuition at four-year public universities tuition-free for families earning less than $125,000. Donald Trump has blamed the federal government's student aid program for driving up costs, and he wants the federal government to get out of the student loan business. But, you know, there's only so much a president can do on any issue without a willing Congress, as we've seen with a lot of President Obama's education proposals. So I don't think education policy folks are holding their breath for a whole lot of change coming out of this election.
That's Amy Scott, Marketplace's senior education correspondent. Thanks so much, Amy.
You're welcome.
Hey, there's a new saint in town. Over the weekend, Pope Francis canonized Mother Teresa, now technically Saint Teresa, although her reputation is for caring for the children and the poor. Those around her found her a bit of a handful when it came to her own care. Her support staff of nuns and a whole team of doctors sometimes struggled to keep up, even as she got older and more frail. Marketplace interviewed one of her doctors in Tijuana, Mexico.
Dr. Patricia Obanel-Riedel. I was privileged to meet Mother Teresa's physician for 7.5 years, the last years of her life. Mother Teresa came here in the late 80s to build up the first house of Missionaries of Charities. Now she has 6 houses in Tijuana. One of the times she came in, she became very, very ill in Tijuana. She had pneumonia, she had a heart condition. She had a few doctors from the United States seeing her and a couple from Mexico. She was not getting better. And that's when I received a call to come in and see Mother. She was 80 years old. That's when I met her. She wouldn't like doctors to see her. She wouldn't accept the care. She was not worried about her disease or her illness. She was always worried about others. She would bring people for cure to doctors, but she would never care of herself. She didn't read a paper. She didn't hear the news. She listened to a radio. She never watched TV. And she knew everything was going on in the world. She would see that there was a war in Beirut.
And she would have a dream that there was a children's hospital that was bombarded. And she woke up with this feeling and said, I must go to Beirut. You know, everybody started moving, all the nuns, you know, you must call the embassy, you must call this, you must do this, we must go. Mother, there's no way to get into Beirut. There's, you know, there's the middle of the war. You know, the borders are closed, you cannot get in. Okay, let's pray, cease of fire. She would convince some fishermen to take her to the border of Beirut from Athens. And as soon as we arrive into the borders of Beirut, cease of fire. Enter into Beirut and rescue the children in this hospital. She took all these kids to different countries to be taken care of. It's absolutely amazing. I could tell you so many beautiful stories.
Marketplace's Kimberly Adams spoke with Dr. Obanel Riedel in Tijuana with the support of the International Women's Media Foundation. And this final note before we go, it's the end of the show. I'm going to do kind of like a dessert thing. According to Bloomberg, ice cream has had an outstanding 2016. It went experimental. One LA flavor is Hawaiian pizza featuring Spam and pineapple. It got a pop-up ice cream museum in Manhattan. Both presidential candidates got custom sundae creations. And Ben of Ben & Jerry's made a political and economic statement with a new flavor in honor of Bernie Sanders. Each pint of Bernie's Yearning features a thin disc of chocolate at the very top to represent, quote, the majority of gains that have gone to the top 1% since the end of the recession. There's a link to Bloomberg's month-by-month wrap-up of ice cream's greatest moments of 2016 at our website, marketplace.org. And that's it. That's our show for this Labor Day. In the U.S., the markets were closed. They will reopen on Tuesday. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I am Molly Wood. Have a great rest of your holiday. I'll meet you back here again tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.